I am a modestly wealthy man, Clinton Codrington told Robin seriously. Since my days as a midshipman, I have saved as much of my pay as I did not need to live by, and of recent years I have been fortunate in the matter of prize money. This, together with the legacy of my mother, would enable me to care very comfortably for a wife. They had lunched with the Portuguese governor at his invitation, and the vino verde that had accompanied the meal of succulent seafood and tasteless stringy beef had given Clinton a flush of courage. Rather than returning immediately to the ship after the meal, he had suggested a tour of the principal city of the Portuguese possessions on the east coast of the African continent. The governor's dilapidated carriage rumbled over the rutted roads and splashed through the puddles formed by the overflow from the open sewers. A raucous flock of ragged child beggars followed them, dancing in their dirty rags to keep pace with the bony, sway-backed mule that drew the carriage, and holding up their tiny, pink-palmed hands for alms. The sun was fierce, but not as fierce as the smells. It was not the appropriate setting for what Clinton Codrington had in mind, and with relief he handed Robin down from the carriage, scattered the beggars by hurling a handful of copper coins down the dusty street, and hurried Robin into the cool gloom of the Roman Catholic Cathedral. The cathedral was the most magnificent building in the city, its towers and spires rising high above the hovels and shacks that surrounded it. However, Robin had difficulty in concentrating on Clinton's declaration in these popish surroundings, amongst the gaudy idols, saints and virgins in scarlet and gold leaf. The reek of incense and the flickering of the massed banks of candles distracted her, even though what he was saying was what she wanted to hear. She wished he had chosen some other place to say it. That very morning she had been taken by a spell of sudden vomiting, and a mild nausea persisted even now. As a physician, she knew exactly what that heralded. Before the courtesy visit to the Portuguese governor's mouldering palace, she had tentatively decided that she would have to take the initiative. That attack of vapours had convinced her of the urgency of the situation, and she had pondered how she could induce Clinton Codrington to stake some sort of claim to the burden she was convinced she was carrying. When Zuga had still lived at King's Lynn with Uncle William, she had discovered a cheaply printed novel of a most disreputable type, concealed amongst the military texts on Zuga's desk. From a furtive study of this publication, she had learned that it was possible for a woman to seduce a man as well as the other way around. Unfortunately, the author had not provided a detailed description of the procedures. She had not even been certain if it were possible in a carriage or whether anything should be said during the process, but now Clinton was obviating the necessity for experiment by a straightforward declaration. Her relief was tinged with shades of disappointment. After having been forced into the decision to carry out his seduction, she had found herself looking forward to the experience. Now, however, she forced herself to assume an attentive expression, and when he hesitated, to encourage him with a nod or a gesture. Even though I am without powerful friends in the service, yet my record is such that I would never expect half-pay appointment. And although it might sound immodest, I would confidently look forward to hoisting my own broad pennant before I am 50 years of age. It was typical of him that he was already thinking 25 years ahead. It required an effort to prevent her irritation showing, for Robin preferred to live in the present, or at least in the immediately foreseeable future. I should point out that an admiral's wife enjoys a great deal of social prestige, he went on comfortably, and her irritation flared higher. Prestige was something she had always intended to win at first hand. Crusader against the slave trade, celebrated pioneer in tropical medicine, writer of admired books on African travel. She could no longer contain it, but her voice was sweet and demure. A woman can have a career as well as being a wife. Clinton drew himself up stiffly. A wife's place is in the home, he intoned, and she opened her mouth, then slowly closed it again. She knew she was bargaining from weakness, and when she was silent, Clinton was encouraged. To begin with, a comfortable little house near the harbour in Portsmouth. Of course, once there are children, one would have to seek larger premises. "You would want many children?" she asked, still sweetly. But with colour mounting in her cheeks. "Oh, yes, indeed, one a year." And Robin recalled those pale drabs with whom she had worked, women with brats hanging from both breasts and every limb. With another one always in the belly, she shuddered, and he was immediately concerned. "Are you cold?" "Oh, no, 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 please, go on." She felt trapped, and not for the first time resented the role that her sex had forced upon her. "Miss Ballantyne, Dr. Ballantyne, what I have been trying to say to you is that I would be greatly honoured if you could find it in yourself to consent to become my wife." Now, when it came, she was not really ready for it, and her confusion was genuine. "Captain Codrington, this comes as such a surprise." "I do not see why. My admiration for you must be apparent. And the other day you led me to believe..." He hesitated, and then with a rush, "You even allowed me to embrace you." Suddenly she was overcome with the urge to burst out laughing. If only he had known her further intentions towards him. But she skittered away from the subject, her expression as solemn as his. "When would we be able to marry?" she asked instead. "Well, on my return to... There is a British consul at Zanzibar, and you are bound there, are you not?" she interrupted quickly. "He could perform the ceremony." Clinton's face lit with slow, deep joy. "Oh, Miss Ballantyne, does that mean... Can I take it that..." He took a pace towards her, and she had a vivid image of the tiny house in Portsmouth, bursting at the seams with little blonde replicas of himself. And she took a quick pace backwards and went on hurriedly, "I need time to think." He stopped. Joy faded, and he said heavily, "Of course. It means such a change in my life. I would have to abandon all my plans. The expedition, it's such a big decision. I could wait a year longer, if necessary, until after the expedition, as long as you wished," he told her earnestly, and she felt a flutter of panic deep in her belly. "No, no, 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 I mean, I need a few days, that is all," and she laid her hand on his forearm. "I will give you an answer before we reach Quelimane, I promise you that." Sheikh Yusuf was a worried man. For 8 days the big dhow-rigged vessel had lain within sight of land. The single huge lateen sail drooped from the long yard. The sea about her was velvet smooth during the day, and afire with phosphorus during the long moonless windless nights. So deep and utter was the calm that not the slightest swell moved the surface. The dhow lay so still that she might have been hard aground. The Sheikh was a master mariner, who owned a fleet of trading vessels, and who for 40 years had threaded the seaways of the Indian Ocean. He knew intimately each island, each headland, and the tricks of the tides that swirled about them. He knew the great roads that the currents cut across the waters, the way a post-coachman knows each turn and dip of the road between his stages. And he could run them without compass or sextant, steering only by the heavenly bodies 1,000 miles and more across open water, making his unerring landfalls on the great Horn of Africa, on the coast of India, and back again onto the island of Zanzibar. In 40 years he had never known the monsoon wind to fail for 8 successive days in this season of the year. All his calculations had been based on the wind standing steady out of the southeast, day and night, hour after hour, day after day. He had taken on his cargo with that expectation, calculating that he could discharge again on Zanzibar Island within 6 days of loading. Naturally, a man expected losses. They were an integral part of his calculations. 10% losses were the very least. 20 was more likely. 30 was acceptable. 40 was always possible. And even losses of 50% would still leave the voyage in profit. But not this. He looked at the stubby foremast, from which drooped the 15-foot-long scarlet banner of the Sultan of Zanzibar, beloved of Allah, ruler of all the Omani Arabs and overlord of the vast tracts of eastern Africa. The banner was faded and soiled as the lateen sail, both of them veterans of 50 such voyages, of calms and hurricanes, of baking sun and the driving torrential rains of the high monsoon, The golden Arabic script that covered the banner was barely legible now, and he had lost count of the number of times it had been taken down from the masthead and carried at the head of his column of armed men deep into the interior of that brooding land on the horizon. How many times had that banner wafted out proudly, long and sinuous as a serpent on the breeze, as he brought his vessel up under the fort at Zanzibar Island. Sheikh Yusuf caught himself dreaming again. It was an old man's failing. He straightened up on the pile of cushions and precious rugs of silk and gold thread and looked down from his command position on the poop deck. His crew lay like dead men in the shade of the sail, their grubby robes folded up over their heads against the heat. Let them lie, he decided. There was nothing mortal man could do now except wait. It was in the hands of Allah now. There is one God, he murmured, and Muhammad is his prophet. It did not occur to him to question his fate, to rail or pray against it. It was God's will, and God is great. Yet he could not help feeling regret. It was 30 years since he had taken such a fine cargo as this, and at prices that compared with those of 30 years before. 330 black pearls, each one perfectly formed, young, by Allah, not one of them over 16 years of age. They were of a people he had never encountered before, for he had never before traded so far south. It was only in this last season that he had heard of the new source of black pearl from beyond the Jin Mountains, that forbidden land from which no man returned. A new people, well-favoured and beautifully formed, strong and tall, sturdy limbs, not those stick-lean legs of the people from beyond the lakes. These had full moon faces and good strong white teeth. Sheikh Yusuf nodded over his pipe. The water bubbled softly in the bowl of the hookah at each inhalation, and he let the smoke trickle out softly between his lips. It had stained his white beard pale yellow at the corners of his mouth, and at each lungful he felt the delightful lethargy steal through his old veins and take the edge off the cold frosts of age, which seemed always now to chill his blood. There was suddenly a higher-pitched shriek that rose above the low hubbub which enveloped the dhow. The sound was part of the ship. Day and night it came up from the slave-hold below the dhow's main deck. Sheikh Yusuf removed the mouthpiece from his lips and cocked his head to listen, combing his fingers through his scraggling white beard. But the shriek was not repeated. It was perhaps the final cry from one of his fine black pearls. Sheikh Yusuf sighed. The din from below decks had slowly decreased in volume while the dhow lay becalmed, and he was able to judge with great accuracy how high his losses were by that volume.